now it's my privilege to introduce our speaker for tonight. This is Pat from up around Fresno. He told me where it was. I'm not going to try to pronounce that.
Thanks, Pat. I'm an alcoholic recovery. Makes me having these raffles right before before I talk like that. It sure makes me nervous. So I think I'm going to win or something, I guess. And then having Dick C topple off the stage is really doing it for me. So I'm a little nervous. Like I said, my name's Pat. I am an alcoholic, and I'm from Madero Rancho. This is where I currently sleep at night. I park my motorhome there, and that's where I sleep. And I lived in Fresno most of my life, though. First of all, I'd like to welcome anybody who's new to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new and you're looking for a way out, I hope you find it here. I did. And I have a sobriety date. It's November 6th, 1997. And I'd like to say that I've stayed sober all by myself, without anybody's help since that date, but that's not the truth. I'm sober today by the grace of God and by the grace of God only. And my willingness to surrender to this program. And there's a lot to that. My drinking career, I couldn't tell you when my first drink was. I remember my mom divorcing my father. Oh, by the way, I was born in, since we're in, are we in Kings County or Tulare County? Okay. I know Kings County is nearby, and I just want to let you guys know, I was born in Avenal. So I was born in Kings County on Easter Sunday, 1958. And I always thought that since I was born on Easter Sunday, and so was Jesus Christ rose on Easter Sunday, I thought that maybe I was the second coming for a long time. And that's why I played God in my own life for so long. But what happened was my father and my mother, they divorced at an early age. I couldn't tell you how old I was, so I was pretty young. But I knew my dad drank a lot, and my mom, she couldn't take it, and she was a member of the Catholic Church, and she tried to raise us Catholic, and back then it wasn't a good idea to get divorced if you were a Catholic, but she couldn't take it anymore, and he was cheating on her, and she moved out of Kalinga. We lived in Kalinga, and she moved me and my brother and my sister to Merced, and I must have been around 6 or 7, and I remember taking my first drink there. And it was at one of the parties that she went to, and I don't remember really how it made me feel. At 6 or 7, I really don't know if I had much of an experience with it, although I knew I got dizzy, and I liked it. Now, it was a long time between that drink and the next time I drank, alcoholically. But what happened was, at 6 years old, I was hanging out with the surfers. There was surfers back then in the early 60s, and there was hoods. And the surfers wore striped shirts and wore like tennis shoes, and the hoods wore, the Beatles were out, and they wore Beetle boots and black clothing. And so 6 years old, I knew I was already trying to search for some kind of an identity. And I don't think I ever have found it all these years, but I know that I was struggling with who I was back then. And I knew I never felt really comfortable in my own skin. My mom ended up marrying a bunch of people. She was married, divorced 5 times, and she drug us from Merced to Tacoma, back down to Concord, California, and then eventually we landed up in Fresno, and I was in 7th grade, and I was a pretty good kid. Life was pretty normal except for all the different stepfathers in the house, and I remember wanted to be a professional motocross racer, and my parents got us involved in it. My stepdad was a good guy and a good provider, and he was able to take us into the motocross arena, and we pursued that for a couple of years. And I remember I knew I never wanted to be an alcoholic like my stepdad. He drank a lot too, and I remember hating him for the way he drank and the way it made my mother feel and the way it caused problems in my house. And so I tried to, you know, be a good guy for a long time. When I hit 16 years old, all hell kind of broke loose there, and my mom had ended up. Oh, thank you very much. My mother had ended up divorcing my stepfather number four, or he left and was off to meet stepfather number five, and she moved out of the house. I was 16 years old. She left me in a house by myself, three-bedroom house, to do whatever I needed to do. And I got a job, and I dropped out of high school, and I tried to grow up really, really quick. And what happened was, from the time I was 16 until the time I was 29, I never drew a sober breath. I stayed drunk for that many years, and I did a lot of other outside issues, and I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, so for respect of this fellowship and this program, I'm not going to really go into a whole lot about that, but I stayed high for 13 years of my life. And, you know, I could go into all the war stories about how many cars I rolled and how many car, you know, how many parked cars I ran into and all that. And I don't really want to bore you with that because we all know how to do that. And, you know, but what I want to say is that for the longest time, I tried to control and enjoy my drinking. And the more I tried to exert control over my drinking, the less, it seemed like the less control I had. And I got to a point... you know, I got married at 19, and I ended up trying to get away from my obsessive drinking habits at 19, and I took my wife, who was pregnant with my first child, and we moved to Aurora, Illinois, and I did that to escape drinking daily. And in Aurora, Illinois, lo and behold, the drinking age is 19, and no matter where I went, there I was. You know, I took my problem with me, and it was never Fresno. You know, surprise, surprise. And so when I got back there, you know, I continued to drink on a daily basis, and I worked for a bread company, and Rainbow Bread, and I was a route salesman, and I ended up, continuing to spiral downhill. My family life wasn't really that great, you know, although we were bringing a child into this world. You know, I didn't really feel like a real responsible father because I was spending a lot of time in bars and drinking a lot. And we ended up moving back to Fresno, and I remember I transferred for that bread company, and I remember 6 months after getting back here, I couldn't stop drinking, and I knew I had to or I was going to lose my job because they were coming to my supervisor was showing up at my house early in the morning waking me up to go to work. And I remember, you know, feeling like, you know, I didn't know what was wrong with me for one thing. I knew nothing of alcoholism. I didn't know that it was a disease. I didn't know that what I was in the middle of was a phenomenon of craving. And I thought what was happening was I was either losing my mind or I was living in hell. And I hated it. And I hated myself. I hated what I become. And I couldn't escape it. And so for the next, I was 21 at that time. And for the next, when I turned 26 years old, my wife had enough. And we'd already brought two more children into this world. I have three children from that first marriage. And I was never there. I was gone all the time. I had lost my job. I was able to get jobs for a while because I would clean up a little bit and get presentable, and I'd be able to go talk and get my foot in the door, and I'd get decent jobs as branch managers here and there and doing different work, sales work and stuff like that. But I was never able to keep them. You know, they have a problem with you taking their money. You know, like when you're embezzling the money from a company, they have a problem, you know, looking over that and past that. And so a lot of times I would quit before I got caught, just out of pride. And so what happened was when I was 27 years old, I couldn't get off a motel drive. In Fresno, I don't know if anybody has ever been to Fresno on motel drive. Lovely place. It's filled with pimps, prostitutes, and, you know, it's not a kind place, and I ended up living there, you know, most of the time, and my wife had enough. And I remember going, sneaking home one time, because I probably ran out of motel money, I don't know, but I remember sneaking home one time, and nobody was there, but there was a note there, and they told me that she was leaving me for another man, and that not to return there anymore. And I became so resentful, and I thought, after all I've done for her, and it was horrible. I mean, I was wallowing in so much self pity and anger that I swore, and this is how sick I was, and I didn't know that it was wrong. I swore that I would never get a job for the rest of my life. I was 27 years old. I would never get a job for the rest of my life, because that meant that bitch was going to get my money. And I remember thinking that and thinking that was normal. And what had happened was, from 27 to 29, I lived on the streets of Fresno, most of the time in my car, if it wasn't impounded at the time. I had a 1974 Mercury Capri, and I used to say that was my address, because wherever that was parked, that's where I lived. And I have a home group also I want to mention. I'm a active member of a home group in Fresno called Life on Life's Terms. And it's kind of like a motel drive version of an AA meeting, an AA fellowship. But in 1986 and 87, I would park in the back of that parking lot where our fellowship is now, and I would spend the night there. Because one of the reasons I did that was, it was 1987, and I had a 1974 car, and I don't know how many thousands of miles it had on it, but it smoked a lot, and I didn't want to really drive it too far around that area of town, because not only was I drinking on a daily basis, I was also on something called methadone, and that's a, that's an attempt at a opiate addiction, getting off of opiates. And I was there was a clinic right by there on Venice and Belmont. So I parked there in that alley, and I'd wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning, and my daily ritual for most part of 2 years was, I'd get up in the morning, and I'd be at the doors, kind of like that. There's an old Target commercial where the ladies doing open. I'd be at the door, waiting for the place to open, because I couldn't sleep anyway. And I'd be at the doors waiting for that place to open so I could get my methadone juice, whatever it was, and I would go from there down to a place on Abbey and Blackstone called HMU Galley Park, and I would go there, and I'd buy a 99-cent bottle of white port. And anybody here familiar with white port? it's one of my favorite drinks, because, not because it tastes good or because it was a good year, but because it was 23% alcohol by volume. And one of the small 99-cent bottles of white port would be just enough for me to start my day. And that's the way I lived. It was like living in hell. I did a lot of things that I'm not real proud of. I was also an experienced burglar, and I broke into a lot of people's houses. I broke into people's houses, garages. I would burglarize pharmacies, whatever I could. If you had a bar, now there's a lot of farmers out here, so I might owe you some amends. In those days, I used to drive around out here in the country, and I would take aluminum siding off of barns and roofs of places, sheds and stuff like that. So if that happened, during the years of like the 80s, come and talk to me. I'll let you know if I was in the area. And if you saw around that time, if you saw a 1957 Ford pickup, it was a buddy of mine. If you saw a 1957 Ford pickup with an old wrecked helicopter on the back of it heading to Fresno, that was me too. We stole that from the Kling Airport. That was the way I lived. I mean, I couldn't work, and that was the way I supported my lifestyle. And like I say, I'm not proud of it, but it's just the way it was. I've since made a lot of amends, some of them that I'll never be able to make. What happened was, in 1989, I was running with a significant other, share. I'll call her significant other. She was a lady of the night, and she was one of us. And if she's not, if she's still alive this day, I would be completely amazed, because she drank like I did. And she, me and her were living in my car together, and we were on a street corner in Fresno. One of the things I used to do was because gas was so cheap back then. It's not like it was now. I wouldn't be able to do that back then. But I used to go to car washes and lift up the grates that the water drains in, and I would people would drop quarters and didn't know that you could lift the grates up, and I'd find a lot of money down there. Not like a lot of money, but I'd find like $2 or $3 in quarters and change, and I'd be able to put a little bit of gas in my car. And I was at one of these places, and an old friend of my first wife saw me at that car wash, and I was 135 pounds, yellow. My skin was yellow. I couldn't hardly form a sentence. She saw me, took one look at me, and said, "What happened?" And I told her exactly what happened. I told her that bitch left me. Because that's what we do, right? We blame others. It's their fault. I'm drunk. I can't help myself. So she said something, that was very appealing to me at the time. This girl had seemingly got her life together in the few years that I hadn't seen her, and she was working as a nurse, and she said, "Come to my house, I'll help you." And when I did that, when she told me that, I got a little bit of hope. So I had my significant other with me at the time, and I convinced her that going out and living with her sister in San Joaquin would be a good idea at this point. And I took her out to San Joaquin, and I dropped her off, and I ended up going over to that girl's house, and I moved in with her that day. Got into a relationship. she was going to help me get sober, right? And that was her intent, was to help me get cleaned up. And within 3 months of that union, she was about as bad a shape as I was. Her mother was an elected official in Fresno County, and her father was a district attorney for the county of Fresno. And they were seeing what was going on with her. They told her that if she didn't check herself into a treatment center, that she was they were going to take her kid away from her. She had a young son from a previous relationship, and it scared her. The book talks about having had a sufficient reason. The problem drinker will be able to stop, and it was a sufficient reason for her to stop at that time. She went into treatment, and like a good alcoholic, I tried to go in, tried to go in with her to the same treatment program. And the doctor, I went to go to the intake to see if I could get in there, and the doctor told me, his name was Dr. Deutsch, he said that, with the, as sick as you are, he goes, you don't need a 30-day program, you need a one-year live-in program. And that kind of floored me, because he also said that if I didn't stop drinking, that I'd be dead in 6 months. And I was 29 years old. I couldn't imagine being dead in 6 months. At that age, I still kind of felt like I was invincible. I had no idea, what that meant. So I went and checked into a one-year program. There was a place in Fresno at the time. It was called the Third Floor, and I went and signed up, I got in there, and then I was committed. The first day that I was there, I was game for a year. Sign me up. Where do I sign up for this year? And after being there for about 30 days, getting a little clarity and getting a little bit of blood back in my drug stream, I was feeling pretty good, and I felt like I probably should leave, And when I left, I went to the other 12-step program, the Narcotics Anonymous program, because of all the drugs I was doing. Because I really wasn't conceiving that I was an alcoholic at that time. It was just too far-fetched for me. I thought you guys were older. I thought you guys, ended up here, from under the bridge, and you still had the brown paper bags, bottles of brown paper bags in the back of your trucks when you got here. And I didn't have that problem. So I ended up going to the other program, and I ended up staying there for 11 months. And in those 11 months, I got a sponsor. The sponsor that I have is still sober today in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, by the way. And I used him as my sponsor for 11 months, but I didn't get honest with anybody. And I ended up you guys told me that I had to make amends. So I wasn't working any steps in order. I really hadn't done a thorough four-step, you know, the way the big book talks about doing it. And I ended up, you know, lying to my sponsor. I went and did my time in jail, but while I was there, I had smoked a little bit of marijuana. And when I got out, I didn't tell him. And he says, "Well, you got 13 months now. We're going to have to give you a cake." And I ended up going to the meeting, you know, after I got out of jail. He gave me a cake and an Asbel Caesar book. And, you know, he was all happy for me. And I was, like, feeling like shit, man. I mean, nobody knew but me. But I felt horrible that I, you know, was accepting that deal when I knew I didn't have the time. And what happened was I ended up going out again, and it got worse. I ended up more desperate, more convinced. Thanksgiving Day, 1989, I was close to the jumping off place. The book talks about, you know, being at a jumping off place. And I was close. And I was living in somebody's garage that was selling me, you know, outside issues. And I was going, and I was back to burglarizing, stealing from department stores, and I'd gotten into cashing stolen checks. Now, some people get away with that. Good criminals can get away with that kind of stuff. Now, the problem is I'm not that good of a criminal, and I try to use my own driver's license and my own name to sign these checks with. And eventually, on Thanksgiving Day, I ended up in Madera at the Madera Food Mart. You see on Gateway. And I ended up there on Thanksgiving Day. I'd cashed a check there the day before, and I thought, well, that worked pretty good. I'll go back the next day. Not too bright. And I ended up, you know, showing up there on Thanksgiving Day with another check, another paycheck. And they told me that they knew that the check was stolen, and they were going to hold me for the police. Like I said, I was desperate. And I had a .25 automatic pistol in my shirt, in my jacket pocket, and I pulled the pistol out, and I pointed it straight at the assistant manager, who was about 6'2" and weighed about 280 pounds, and I said, "You're not keeping me for anybody. I'm walking out of here." And the guy was either stupid or he knew I wouldn't shoot him, and I don't know what it is, but he rushed me, and we ended up going in, you know, getting into the struggle for that gun over the, there's a stack of dog food and some rock salt stuff. In those days, in the old grocery stores, they used to have big plate glass windows, and they'd put the dog food, and they used to have stacks in front of the window. Well, we went over those stacks of dog food through the plate glass window with my face first, and we ended up on the parking lot, and all I remember is seeing a cop car pull up, you know, next to me with this guy on my back, you know, beating my head in the concrete, and then one last bang, and the cop had knocked me out with a billy club. And I came to in the Madera Hospital, and I remember looking at the nurse with a face of complete contempt and hatred for the kind of person that I was. And I'd seen that face before, the disgust in her eyes, and how, you know, what a piece of dirt I was. And they didn't really want to treat me, but they treated me, and I ended up going to jail, going into my cell that night, and I prayed to God, "Please let me have another chance at sobriety." And God gave me another chance of sobriety. I ended up going to another treatment center. It's called California State Prison. I was there. I got a 3-year sentence. I had 77 felony counts on me, and I ended up getting 3 years out of that. And I ended up going to a place called CRC, and I went down there, and Alcoholics Anonymous was down there. And I got introduced to this program in the penitentiary, and man, the people were phenomenal. They came in and they showed me exactly in that book, you know, how there was specific direction on how to work the steps out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I could never find them before. I mean, even if I read it to this day and not knowing anything about it, I couldn't tell you where the steps were. But these guys showed us, and specifically they showed us how to work a 4-step. The cool thing was that they asked us while we were there to get a temporary sponsor. And there was a guy, his name was Tom. We used to call him Colonel Tom because he looked like Colonel Sanders. He had a goatee mustache, with a real long goatee mustache. And when he was arrested, he was arrested in women's clothing. And when he went before the judge, he told the judge his name was Zoltar and he was from the planet Romulan. And he was going to be my sponsor. You know, I heard that guy share that, and so I thought, that guy's going to be my temporary sponsor because I could probably tell him anything, you know, in this fifth step. And I did. And I did a fifth step on the yard down there in North Corona on a Sunday morning, one morning, and I had a spiritual experience. And I walked back into our dorms. We had dormitories. I walked back into the dormitory that morning, and this friend of mine that I went down to prison with was sitting on his bunk, you know, doing a little pattern for a tattoo he was going to do later on that afternoon. And I remember looking at this guy, and his eyes, he looked like a deer in the headlights. His eyes came wide open. He looked at me, and his mouth dropped open. He says, he goes, "Pat, you're glowing," you know. And I'm going to tell you something. Being able to do a fifth step with another person, you know, it freed me from a lot of the guilt, shame, and remorse that I had. Not all of it, but it freed me from a lot of it. And I felt free, you know, and it was a spiritual awakening for me. And I ended up getting out and I ended up doing these things. Now, they told us in there to, you know, when we get out, to go to a lot of meetings, of course, you know, more meetings are important. And that's what I did. I got out, went to meetings. They also told us that if, you know, if we were wanting to stay sober, we'd need to sponsor other people. And so, when I got out, it was, 2001, by the first 6 months I was back in Fresno and working the program, going to a lot of meetings. I ended up getting my very first sponsee, and his name is Jack Daniels, and that's he's still sober today. It's not my doing, but he was the very first guy I ever sponsored, and his name had to be Jack Daniels. But I was able to do a fifth step with him and watch him grow in the program, and what happened was I forgot that I had this disease, really is what it was. I forgot that it was coming back and powerful. I forgot that it was progressive, and I had no idea that if I didn't treat it, it would get worse. And that's what happened. And at 4 years sober, I found it necessary to take a drink. And I ended up going out for a little while. Came back in the program, after about 3 months. Got a new sponsor because I figured it must be the old sponsor's fault. It's always their fault. And got a new sponsor. I started this journey again, and I stayed sober 2 years. And then I found it necessary to drink again, and I fired that sponsor, and I came back in. And at that time, it was around 2005, and where I ended up was on that relapse was I had already got my conference tickets and registration and all that for the international conference in San Diego. And I went down there with the full intention of getting sober. Actually, my intention was getting struck sober. I thought what I would do with my plan was I was going to go down when Clancy, you know, was sharing the big meeting on Saturday night, and I'd have Clancy give me a big book, and then I would be sober from that point on. That would be my new story. And it didn't happen like that. I ended up fighting with that girl who had picked me up off that street corner. I ended up fighting with her because by that time she was my fiance, and we were married shortly after that. But what happened was I didn't get sober, but I met a guy in Alcoholics Anonymous. He told me to go to the first meeting that I could and get honest. Get honest with the group. You know, even if it's not your home group, just get honest and tell them what you've done. And that's what I did. I ended up back in a Harbor Lights in 2005 over there at Morro Bay, the Harbor Lights group. And I got honest, and I was able to stay sober for a couple more years. And of course with the new sponsor. 1995, yeah, thank you. In 1997 now, I had been sober 2 years, and I started drinking again. And in 1997, what happened was I ended up back on Motel Drive, and I was miserable sober. And I'm going to tell you the truth. Being sober without not treating my disease is way worse than living on the streets in 1987 in my 1974 mercury degree. It was way worse. Back then, you know, I didn't have any hope. you know, there was nothing to be hopeful for. There was nothing really to live for anymore. I was blotting out the misery in my life by drinking. But being sober, having been around here a while and seeing people actually get this program and actually, living a happy, useful, sober life made it miserable for me to stay here without a treatment. And I didn't know. You know, I didn't know that the solution was in this book. I didn't know. And as many sponsors I had, and I'm sure they told me, you know, they were staying sober. But I wasn't ready to listen. And what happened was, in 1997, I drank for the last time, and I just resigned myself to being a miserable failure at Alcoholics Anonymous, at life, at being a son, at being a father, you know, at being a member of society. I just resigned myself to that fact that I was probably one of these people who were going to have to die drunk. And I was up in a motel room, back on Motel Drive, on the third floor of the Welcome Inn Hotel, the motel, the penthouse suite, the third floor. And I was up there praying to God to just let me die, you know, and asking Him in a journal, you know, for some kind of help. And at that time, I'd been going to Fresno Fellowship, and there was a guy there that I'd met, and I didn't know, you know, somebody told him that I'd relapsed, I guess, because he went out looking for me. And that man is Ray right there, Ray and I. And he came looking for me, and he knocked on that door, and when I opened it up, he said to me, he asked me, Pat, what happened? And I told him, I'm in a relapse, and I can't stop. And he told me, come to my house, I'll help you. And I still had a little bit of alcohol and some prescription pain pills left, so I told him I'd be by tomorrow. And I showed up the next day. I showed up the next day, and I went through 3 days of the worst detox that I've ever experienced in my life. And that man helped me. I mean, he put me in a bathtub whenever I was too, my bones hurt too bad to move. He emptied the wastebasket next to the bed that he let me sleep in, a spare room of him and his partner's house. He went to the store when I didn't want to eat anything. He went to the store and bought me some Lucky Charms because I like the marshmallows. You know, he was a loving person that wanted to genuinely help me. And nobody had ever done that before. The third day of that detox and those withdrawals, and I was seeing things, and I was in a lot of pain, and I was hurting, and I couldn't hurt anymore. I didn't want to hurt anymore, and I crawled out of bed to puke one more time, and I crawled over to the window. It was a cold, foggy November night. And I was looking out into the fog, you know, through this window, and I was praying out loud, God, please let me die. I don't want to live anymore. Life is too painful. In the big book on page 152, it says, then he will know loneliness as such as few do. He will be at the jumping off place. He will wish for the end. And I think that's what it took, you know, for me. And little did I know it, you know, Ray was standing behind me in the doorway. And if any of you guys know Ray and you know his laugh, he started laughing. And there was nothing in that room to laugh at. I was filled with self-pity, oozing from every pore, and this guy was laughing at me. And I was floored, you know. How could you laugh at this? You know, I mean, I'm begging God to kill me, you know. He told me something at that point that I haven't forgot for November 6th, it'll be 17 years. But something he told me that I never want to forget is he told me, Pat, he goes, you're not going to die. You're going to live so that you can do this, what I'm doing for you, for somebody else. And I believe today, with all my heart, that is the essence of the Alcoholics Anonymous program. I believe today that my life depends on doing that. And so, really, it was an amazing thing. An amazing discovery to be around the program for 10 years and not ever know that. Today, I'm just going to jump to today, a little side note of that, just to let Ray know. I've got a guy that I've been sponsoring for a number of years that's been struggling with this program. And there's only so much a human can do for us. But the one little thing that I could do for this sponsee that I've got that's trying to detox himself and his roach-infested apartment that he's living in right now, the one little thing that I could do to take him on his sixth day of, you know, no drugs or alcohol is to take him by a couple cans of chicken noodle soup and some Gatorade. And I'm telling you what, man, I wouldn't want to, that was the highlight of my day, to being able to go do that for that man, because he was so grateful, you know. Now, what has happened as a result of, you know, that moment? And I left Ray's house about on the fourth day, and I went to work. I went to work for Alcoholics Anonymous because I believe that if my life depends on my self-sacrifice and service to others, then I'm going to get busy, because my life is, the life I've been given today is a beautiful thing. I wouldn't want to miss the kind of life I'm living, you know. And I would have missed so much. I started sponsoring people, you know, right away. At 3 months, I had a guy come up to me and ask me if I would sponsor him. And only having 3 months, I ran it by my sponsor. By the way, I got a man to sponsor me. Well, actually, I didn't get him to sponsor me. The group that I was going to assign him to me. His name was Howdy, and he told, he came up to me and asked me if I was willing to go to A Lang. And I said, yeah, I'll do anything that you ask. You know, and he said, all right, well, this is what I want you to do. I want you to call me every day for 90 days. I want you to go to a meeting every day for 90 days. I want you to meet me once a week because we're going to study the big book together. And that's what I did. I made that deal with him, and when I left that parking lot that morning, I said a prayer out loud, and I made a pledge to God that I would do everything that man asked me to do for 1 year. And if what he asked me to do didn't work, then I promised God and myself that I was going to go on a crusade to every 12-step meeting that I could find and tell you you're all full of shit. And lucky for you, I haven't had to do that yet. And what happened was I got really active in sponsoring men in this program. And there's one requirement for that. You know, I have to have worked the steps myself and have had to have a spiritual awakening. I spent a lot of time studying this book, this literature, the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope that I've learned something. What I do know is that the people who do what I've been doing and what my sponsor did, the people who do that are staying sober. What I do for my recovery is when I worked those steps, it wasn't something that I waited on. I learned that in early Alcoholics Anonymous, they used to take people through the steps, you know, in rapid succession. Matter of fact, before the 12 steps were even introduced, I was told that the six tenets of the Oxford movement were actually done within the first week of somebody coming in through the doors, and the people had spiritual awakenings, and the results, you know, the statistics of people staying sober were much better than we have today, and I figured that was probably the reason, because I know for me, when I came into this program and I didn't work the steps, I stayed miserable. You know, I talked about being miserable sober, and I didn't want to live like that anymore. So when I got back into this program and made that deal with my sponsor, I agreed to doing what was in this book and nothing else, because there's a lot of things said in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings that's not Alcoholics Anonymous, and I watch people come in here and I've watched people die from trying to work that kind of a program. And so what I did was I started going to a lot of these real serious, you know, back to buy the book group and Common Solutions Roundup. I mean, you talk about pulling teeth. It's like, you know, I went to some meetings, some big book studies, where we read one paragraph in an hour meeting. And, you know, come on, let's get going here. And it's like we're reading, we're dissecting this damn paragraph to death. You know, and it used to drive me crazy because I didn't see the point of it. You know, we weren't making any grounds here. Let's get back to the stories, you know, the good stuff. And what happened was, when I was able to take this book and have an experience with it, I was able to actually apply some of that stuff in my life. I was able to see where it was truly God keeping me sober. It was no longer me or my sponsor or the meetings, you know, or my cleaning coffee pots or sponsoring people. It's not none of that. It was God. But I had to do all the rest of this work to keep myself clear so that I could have God in my life. I am not a virtuous person by nature. And selfish and self-centered. And I have to do this work. I have to do the inventory. I have to be current with the sponsor. I have to let him know what I'm thinking. And in order for me to be able to stay, you know, to have this unblocked conscious contact with God. And it's not easy. I mean, there's been times in my sobriety. At 6 years sober, I was at a kind of a jumping off place there too. At 6 years sober, I was going through a problem with my third marriage. And because, you know, the book talks about we were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't handle our emotional natures. You know, we were having problems in our relationships. I was having a problem in my relationships. And the only thing that I knew to do was to get out because I couldn't take it anymore. And I was so miserable in that relationship that I was sitting at a desk with a loaded .38 that was given to me by another member of Alcoholics Anonymous that was afraid to help have it because he thought he was going to shoot himself. And, you know, and I couldn't take it, you know. And so what happened was, you know, I have to stay active in this program. There was a guy who I listened to that spoke one time that talked about if this disease is truly progressive, then what that means is that it gets worse even if I don't drink. You know what I mean? And he said that he goes, so the longer I'm in AA, that doesn't mean that I can do less. It means that I got to do more. And I've stayed active in this program. One of the things, my service commitments right now are not really as big as they have been. You know, I'm a secretary for my home group, my home fellowship. I'm not the secretary, I'm the treasurer for that group. And that takes a lot of time counting all them pennies because we have kind of a low bottom shelf helper there. You know, we gotta get a couple $100 in change. It takes a little while to go through that, sift through that. But that takes my time. But I also enjoy working with others. And to this date, I've never said no. In almost 17 years, I've never said no to anybody who's asked me to sponsor them. And I owe my life to every one of those men and women that I've sponsored. Because it's me, them allowing me to help them, that has kept me here. That was the one major thing that was missing in my 10 years and the fellowship, you know, because I would come to meetings as soon as they started and then I'd leave the meetings before they were over or as soon as they were over. And I didn't get to know people. I didn't let people get to know me. I didn't go to coffee. I didn't want to go on any, you know, trips or anything like that. So what I've done is I've gotten busy, active in service. I sponsor a lot of men. I always like to have at least one or two guys on the south side of the fifth step so I have something to look forward to with these guys and help them work their four step. And it's been an honor and a privilege to be able to see the light come on in other people's eyes. People who are hopeless as I was, you know, be able to live happy, purposeful, useful lives. You know, and I've been able to do that. Now, I've sponsored over 100 men and women in the last 17 years. And not all of those people are here. I sponsored one gentleman who I thought was, you know, I thought he was doing great. He was doing the step work. He was speaking one Friday night. Me and Billy were down and we wanted a little trip to Hollywood. And we were down in Hollywood one night, you know, 1 year. And we got this phone call. This sponsee of mine, his name was Russ. He just spoke at the what's the name of that group? The home group fellowship. He was a speaker, the Friday night speaker at the home group fellowship. On the way home from that meeting, I guess he got into an argument with his girlfriend. And later on that night, he hung himself in his apartment. And cunning, baffling, powerful. You know, and a lot of people that have come in here that have used Alcoholics Anonymous like it was the hometown buffet, like a smorgasbord, take what you want and leave the rest. Did you hear that in meetings? You know, they've left. Some of them have died. the ones who stick around here are the ones who get active in the service, the ones who stay busy, you know, go to H&I meetings, do something for their home group, participate in fellowship activities. Those are the people that I see get to stay around here. There's a whole bunch of guys, you know, in this meeting come down here and that have been in my life and they have enriched my life to beyond measure. I could not tell you what it's like to be able to see a host of a fellowship grow up around you. It's been an amazing journey. The other thing that you get to have, you know, that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me is I mentioned that I've been married and divorced 3 times. I'm not proud of that. I was a crappy husband, crappy boyfriend. But, you know, I take an inventory every night now. Or I try to every night, 10-step. And I get to ask myself, what could I have done better? You know, how could I have been more kind, tolerant, loving, patient with the people in my life? And I'm able to look at that, and I get to be a little bit better every day, I hope. And so, you know, for the last 7 years, I've been taking, you know, my time. I've been dating the same woman 7 years. 7 years I've been dating the same beautiful woman who is in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she tolerates me, you know, and I don't want to rush it, you know, because being married 3 times is not, I don't have that good a track record. But we've been engaged now for about a year. Christmas it'll be a year, and I figure by, you know, I don't know, soon we'll get married, but she puts up with me, and you know, but it's been fun, you know. I haven't taken it seriously. I haven't taken any hostage. I let her be her. She lets me be me. You know, it's kind of a neat deal, man. She lets me be who God wanted me to be, and it's okay. You know, I had no idea that a relationship could be so much fun, because I kind of had relationships that they have that acronym for, and it goes RELATIONSHIP, really exciting love affair, turns into outrageous nightmare, sobriety hangs in peril. And that's the way my relationships always were, you know, because I get into these relationships, and before I know it, they're my higher power. And I don't want to live like that anymore, man. There's only one God, and I found that fact deep down inside me. You know, it's there where I have to seek it. You know, not in another person, not in more money, not in a job. I have to seek that power deep down inside me. And that's what the steps do. They enable me to clear away enough of me so that I can allow the light of God to shine. And he has, man. I've been so blessed. I couldn't even tell you. I have 3 kids from my first marriage. I have 1 kid from my second marriage. My oldest kids, you know, they're all grown up. My oldest is 36. I'm real bad with ages. But the oldest one's 36, and you know, she's got brother and sister that are doing, you know, they're doing okay. The oldest one's struggling, you know, with this disease right now, but the other two are doing real well. The youngest one turns 18 in December. She's never seen me drunk, ever. When she was a baby, I was drunk, but she doesn't remember it. And thank God she didn't, because I drove with her drunk, and she was in the car with me drunk, and thank God I didn't kill her, you know, because she's grown up to be a beautiful young woman, and she's a big blessing in my life. And you guys here have taught me how to be a father. You taught me how to be a son. My mother, all she ever wanted, when I went to make amends to my mother, all she ever wanted was for me to be sober. And you guys gave that to her, and I thank you for that. Because she died a couple years ago knowing that her son was going to be okay. And so you guys have given me that. You guys have given me so much. I saw people here living the kind of lives that I only thought good people, you know, were supposed to live. And I never thought I deserved it. I hated me when I got here. There was nobody that hated me worse than me. And I hurt people a lot, you know, in my life. But nobody hated me worse than me. And when I got here, I didn't think I deserved anything good. But you guys here showed me how to suit up and show up. And you showed me how to be responsible. You showed me how to be where I say I'm going to be, when I say I'm going to be there, and do what I say I'm going to do, when I say I'm going to do it. You know, my sponsor told me that if I did that, it would give me something that I never knew, that I never had. And I asked him, what was that? He said, it's called integrity. And you guys have given me integrity. You know, you guys taught me that if I have goals in my life to pursue them and not be afraid of the rejection of failure, not be afraid of, you know, not being good enough, just go do it. And I signed up for college and I graduated from Fresno State with a bachelor's degree, and I was able to go to work in a field that I absolutely love. And I have a job today that gives me, you know, freedom to do this work if I need to. If I need to go sit with a sponsee or take some time off, I can go do that. You know, matter of fact, Reyes would work for the same outfit. And I'm able to do that today if I have to. And nothing comes up, but that's what I do for money. You know, I mean, that job that this program has given me, I'm able to do that for money, to be able to have food on my plate, to be able to take care of my children, to be able to take care of my fiance. What I do for a living, what I do for a job, is Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't put anything before this program. The book tells me that if anything comes before it, I'll lose it. If I put anything before my sobriety, I'll lose it. And so I don't. Sobriety is job number one. And you know, before I even read it in the book, and I know it's in there somewhere, but I don't have time and I didn't really mark it up this time, but my sponsor told me to write down these priorities. And I have the guys that I sponsor write it in their book. And if you ever run into a big book somewhere that these are written in there, it may have came from my sponsor, Howdy, because he had all of his guys write in the book, and so do I. But the priorities are God, AA, and working with others. For me, God and Alcoholics Anonymous are synonymous. They're the same thing. I can't have God without AA, and I never could have AA without God. So they have to be synonymous. So they come number one for me. And next is my job, what I do for money. And the third thing is on my priority list is my family. And I thought, you know, I told this guy, I said, they always told me that my family had to come first. How does that work? He goes, that's for normal people, Pat. You're not normal. And he said, you know, for you have to put sobriety first because you've tried putting your family first and you've got drunk before. He goes, so for you, you have to put sobriety first, and then maybe you'll be able to show up for a job and not get fired. And then if you have a job, maybe you'll have some money to take home to your family and take care of them. You know, I never understood that kind of stuff. It's real simple, huh? But I didn't get it. And so he showed me, you know, how to do simple stuff like that, and pay my bills on time. You know, treat people kind. Don't lie. You know, simple stuff. And I began to see where that stuff would actually make me feel a little bit better about myself. So. I want to tell you a little bit about some amends that I made, and then I'm going to close. But the first 10 years that I was in the program, I thought I might have did a pretty decent job of working the steps. You know, I conceded to my normal self that I had this problem, never really being thoroughly convinced, though, that I, you know, that this was really a disease. But I thought, you know, I had a semi-good grasp on it. And I had no problem believing in God. I pray every day. And making the decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God was something that I was trying to do every day. But what I failed to do, and it's a big part of the program, what I failed to do was get honest about my ninth step. I had an eighth step amends list that I had was, it filled up an entire page, and it's probably not all the people that I'd harmed. And I was going through that eighth step amends list and making some of my amends, I had to go see my brother. My brother I hadn't had communication with from the time he moved out of the house when I was 16. He left me when my mom left me, and didn't want anything to do with me because I was a party hound and he was kind of a square. And he didn't want nothing to do with me, and I didn't see him probably for 25 years. And when I finally went and made amends to him, I told him I had something to tell him, and would he be willing to listen? And he took one look at me and he goes, "Who's making you say this?" You know, he thought I joined a cult or something, you know, and somebody was making me say I was sorry. He couldn't believe it. And I was able to clear that up, and we ended up having, you know, we got a great relationship today, me and my brother, but my older brother. But there was a one amend in particular that was pretty, I was at a meeting in Fresno, a village group. If any of you guys know about Fresno, there's a place called the Village Group. They meet every Friday night. Well, I was there listening, you know, one more meeting, listening to this people sharing at the meeting. There was a guy talking about, you know, how he burned his family's business to the ground, you know, doing drugs and drinking, and you know, where he was talking about, you know, the businesses that he owned and all that. I kind of figured out this guy was a guy that I'd worked for. I did a landscaping job for him, you know, in the early 80s, and early 80s, I did a landscaping job for him, and when I was at that landscaping job, his garage door was open, and I went into his garage, and I stole a guitar and an amplifier out of his garage. And I didn't see the guy, you know, I mean, I never saw the guy, never got caught, you know. And this guy was talking, and I went up to him at this meeting, and I said, Bruce, you know, I said, I think I owe you an amends. I said, did you live in this house at this time? Did you have this contractor working on your landscape? He goes, yeah, that was me. I said, well, I have an amends to make if you're willing to hear it. He goes, yeah, absolutely, whatever. He was all happy to be in AA and sober at that time, too. He's on a pink cloud or something. But so I told this guy, I said, you know, I was there, and I snuck into your garage, and I stole a guitar and amplifier out of your garage. And his mouth dropped almost to the pavement. And he stood there, not, you know, with his mouth wide open, just staring at me. And he said, for the last 15 years, I've been blaming my nephew for that. The guy was, you know, willing to take the amends, and I didn't have a lot of money at the time, but I may, you know, the book says we either pay or we make arrangements to pay. And so I told him to come up with a number and let me know what it was, and whatever it was, I was willing to make it right. And he came up with a number, and for the next year and a half, I paid off that, you know, that amends. And I was thinking that, like, I probably owe his nephew an amends, but never made that amends to him, but I guess if God sees fit to put him in front of me. But, you know, the thing was that with every one of those amends I made, see, I always heard people in the meeting say, and even therapists, I go to therapists, you know, trying to get marriage therapy, you know. And to me, marriage therapy is just, you know, having my wife having somebody else to help me change my mind, you know, get them on their side. But I never understood therapy. But they always tell me, you're filled with so much guilt and shame. They go, you got to forgive yourself, Pat. You know, because they hated me, you know. And what happened with the nice step of amends, and I think that freed me, you know, more than anything, was with every amends that I made, I was able to look into the eyes of forgiveness. And with every amends I made, their forgiveness of me enabled me to be a little more forgiving of myself. See, if I had the power to cure me or forgive me, I wouldn't need Alcoholics Anonymous. If I had the power to keep me sober, I wouldn't need Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and so that's what it was happening. And so now today, if I believe my life depends on me promptly admitting it, you know, when I'm wrong. And so, you know, if you're new, I hope you heard something. I don't know if I said anything that made any sense, but I want to tell you that Alcoholics Anonymous has saved my life. And I've seen it save many lives of other people. And the book talks about the age of miracles being still with us, and I believe that. I'm so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. If I lived to be 100, I wouldn't live long enough to pay Alcoholics Anonymous back. So, and you guys have been so gracious here for allowing me to come and be a service and share my experience, strength, and hope with you. You know, phenomenal. I really enjoyed meeting all you people. There's a big, hope you're all coming down to the petitions play tomorrow. I'll see you down there. But thank you for letting me share.